Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored? Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
Achtung, Achtung, welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk USA with me, Al Murray, James Holland and John McManus. And obviously, John, you're as keen as anyone else to talk about Masters of the Air because it's incredible, isn't it?
It really is. And I mean, I've been looking forward to this for years. I love Don's book, obviously. And it's just been, it seems like it's been about 10 years or so that this whole thing has been in process. And now to see it come out, the only frustrating thing is it seems like there's only one episode dropping per week. And my appetite is whetted for more.
I quite like that. It's old school having it kind of, you know, having to make you wait and stuff rather than sort of be a glutton on these things.
I know.
I mean, what I'm finding is I'm watching each episode multiple times, even though I haven't got time to watch one of them really at the moment. And episode 5, I mean, oh my goodness me. The monster attack, which, you know, we've talked about on the podcast, Al, and you know, that's one where kind of 13 go out, only one comes back or whatever it is. I mean, it's just astonishing. And I thought that was so brilliantly done.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I can't really fault it at all. The only thing I would question is the use of a German farmer of a tractor in the distance, but I'll kind of let that one go.
He wouldn't have fuel for that tractor, probably, right?
He wouldn't have had the tractor and he wouldn't have had the fuel.
Yeah. You know.
Well, they need to go to Russia. Well,
yeah,
Ukraine,
yeah,
right?
Of course. Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
But that's my one.
That's your one quibble.
That's my one quibble.
Well, what I like about it, yeah, I mean, it is the unvarnished truth because a lot of these, you know, as we all know, a lot of productions that you watch, the good guys never get hurt and, you know, and they're just mowing down the bad guys or whatever. And you even see that in some World War II movies that purport to be truthful. In this, you see the unfortunate reality that the 100th Bomb Group was basically dying in the fall of 1943. I mean, they were just getting decimated.
What's interesting is even given that, this is the biggest show that Apple TV have had. It's launched bigger than anything else they've had. So that it's quite interesting. There's an appetite for, A, the Second World War, be something that isn't, you know, dramatized to the point of sort of being unrealistic. I think that in itself is fantastic. Fascinating. I mean, obviously, the extremely hot cast is helping me watch it with my other half because she's like, oh, right, are they, you know, is Elvis in it this week, basically? but I think it's fascinating because, you know, that every so often there's this idea that no one's interested in the Second World War anymore and that it's, and we've got over it and we should get over it or it's old news or whatever. And then you make a thing like this that, I mean, it's a modern sensibility, isn't it? To show it in an unvarnished form, isn't it? to make it like this is and it be so successful. I think for those of us in the business of talking about the subject, I think this is, it's a fantastic sign, isn't it? Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think it is. But I also think the other thing is that, that's really struck me over the last kind of year of watching events unfold in Europe and the Middle East is that the reference points for those conflicts is the Second World War rather than the conflicts that have happened in between. You know, it's mass destruction of cities and towns. It's unbelievably wanton artillery fire. It's casualties on a scale that is absolutely indicative of the Second World War rather than the kind of sort of comparatively small casualties that have been experienced, certainly in the West, in conflicts in between. And here we've got this series which shows you in a completely unvarnished exactly those scales of losses and scales of destruction. And there's a kind of poignancy to this, I think, that absolutely wouldn't have been there when they were first conceiving, when John Orloff was first writing the script and first conceiving the whole series. It's got this added poignancy now, you know, because of the time in which we're watching it. I mean, it's just, it's completely compelling, but also kind of sort of horrifying at the same time.
Yeah, this sort of one-off in history where you actually had these bomber crews flying deep into enemy skies, suffering these kinds of losses without escort, at least for several months, you know, is fortunately never going to happen again. And you really do see the human cost of this on so many levels. For me, too, it actually takes me back to when I was doing research for Deadly Sky, which was, I mean, God, seems like ages ago because it was, but this was my second book and I was immersed in this world. It was right around the time the Mighty 8th Air Force Heritage Museum opened in Savannah, and that place, I mean, you guys have been there, I assume.
I have, yeah.
I mean, it's just incredible on so many levels as a museum piece, but also from a primary source point of view in their archive. My God, the riches are there that were just amazing. And then going to East Anglia, to the airfields, again, just kind of immersing into that world, it just kind of took me back into that mindset of what was about the least glamorous kind of warfare you can imagine, even though many perceived it otherwise. And I like that they're conveying that.
Yeah, I think they're really capturing it. And they tackled it in the last episode, the fifth episode I saw, which is that, I think the last one that's aired here as well. Anyway, where they say, we've got to do this now so that more people aren't killed doing it later. You know, that's the thing that's pushing them on to carry on getting back in the aircraft. Because I'm wondering what would have incentivized me to do any of that. And the answer is not a lot. And yet they did. And they knew what the odds were. And the other thing is until there is escort, the prospect of escort fighters, which they don't know about, they're not conscious of, where's the light at the end of the tunnel? There isn't any.
I think the other thing that's come across very well, and you kind of sort of hinted at this really, is the kind of the random nature of the violence. And you just don't know who's going to get it and who's going to survive. And you don't know whether you're going to be able to bail out or whether your whole plane's going to be blown up. And, you know, and also the fact that, of course, that so many men getting wounded on their ship and still kind of getting back to base, but then in really, really big trouble. I mean, it's all of that is just conveyed brilliantly. And I've also thought the other thing is the kind of sort of morality of it and the fact that you've got one of the crews sort of going, but we can't do that. You know, that means we're going to be hitting civilians. And the other one going, who cares? You know, which is exactly how it would have been.
Yeah, right. That's exactly right. That was so well done because there were crews who spoke up about the Munster raid because it was really the first time the 8th Air Force was thinking in terms of, quote, dehousing German workers. In other words, killing German civilians, which wasn't supposed to be our concept, you know, the daylight precision bombing and all that. I remember, you know, one source I found, this was a guy who was in briefing and he remembered somebody, one of the, you know, a member of another crew standing up and very emotionally saying that he was not going to fly that mission. And I like that they kind of address that in addition to also after the mission, a guy riding back in the truck saying, they can't make me go up again. I'm not going up again. And it's like, you know, like Al was just saying, what would induce me to continue doing this? And I think that guy is kind of speaking for the audience on some level, yes. Isn't he? I mean, we're all like, no, I don't want any more of this.
Yeah. I mean, I think that really, I mean, it's been interesting watching people. And the other thing, it's been quite interesting watching people online try and find fault in it with a couple of things with the program. One of them being there's no character development, but that's the point. People would come on your station. They'd try and chat up the girls on the, you know, in the coffee wagon, and then they'd be dead because of the complete random churn of the thing that was totally unpredictable and totally, I mean, as you say, Jim, random, that there's no rhyme nor reason to any of it. It also makes you sort of think about pilots who are aces. They're lucky principally, aren't they? They have the good fortune to be in the right place at the right time, fire their guns in the right direction, generally, rather than necessarily having any particular knack for it. You know what I mean? When you see the fleets of bombers and those aircraft screaming in, I mean, how hard is it to miss? Well, it's easy to miss, it would seem, because some aircraft do emerge unscathed, but how hard is it to hit someone? Not that difficult, because plenty are being shot down. It's just the sort of, the fact that there is absolutely no structure or rhyme or reason to what might happen to you, I think is the thing really worth remembering, you know, that, And it applies to all battlefields, doesn't it? You can be the sharpest man with the best field craft imaginable, but if someone 8 miles away with a long tom happens to aim a shell in your direction, it lands on you. There's nothing you can do about that.
Yeah, you're done.
You're done. It's over, and it's completely random. And you can be moving as fast as you need to and zigzagging like crazy, but they'll get you. Fate has it in store, and it's hard not to feel sort of fatalistic about the whole thing watching it. That, you know, there's no, now I'm watching, I think there's no point even though I sort of roughly know what's to come, you sort of think, well, there's no point liking that character because he's toast.
Yeah, which is very real to the time, isn't it?
Exactly.
I can't get too close to anybody. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And the price you pay if you are close to someone, personally, I think is the other thing that's creeping into the story. It's fascinating. Brilliantly done. But what we're going to do on the podcast is when Masters of the Air is finish, when it's completed its run, when the 8th Air Force go out in their last raid on April the 25th, isn't it, 1945, when they've hung up their spurs and the program has ended, and I expect some people will have either made it home through escape runs or anyway, whatever, we will talk about the series in full on this podcast and give it the full turning over, and hopefully contain that in one episode. However, what we're going to do today, and the sharp-eyed of you on social media saw this, we're going to ask some questions. Well, I'm going to ask the questions on behalf of the listeners of Jim and John, and I might pop in with my own opinion here and there, but maybe not, because I these are great questions, and I'd like to see them. I'd like to see what you think, John, to be honest. And the first question is from Rob Jones, and thanks everyone for sending these in, and there's a wide variety of stuff, and we aren't going to be able to answer them all, and maybe in We Have Way Star we'll only answer two of them. Anyway, Rob Jones asks, to what extent did the Second World War set the tone for US foreign policy since then? And do you foresee circumstances under which it might return to the isolations of the 1920s and 30s? Has that started to happen in the last decade?
You know, if we're thinking of the broader sweep of like modern US history, what we'll call isolationism, non-interventionism, America first, whatever you want to call it, has been a strain that's been there. It's just a question of whether it's predominant or influential at any given time. So, for instance, I mean, if it's the first decade of the 20th century, there's pretty much consensus in this country that we stay out of Europe. We're more interested in, you know, the Far East and what's going on in Cuba and, you know, so on and so forth. Of course, then you have World War One. And that's a kind of an outlier because there's profound disillusionment with involvement in Europe, of course, famously in the 20s and 30s. But, you know, World War II seems to KO isolationism, but it really doesn't, because it comes back after the war in the form of really drastically curtailing our conventional military forces in the late 40s. And then later, interestingly enough, during the Cold War, especially Vietnam to post-Vietnam, isolationism had a home in sort of the left-wing part of the Democratic Party of saying, we're not going to be involved in all these little Cold War hotspots anymore. We don't even believe in those missions. And it's odd because that was sort of the predominant strain for a time. But then as of the sort of immediate supposed post-Cold War period, early 90s, all of a sudden it comes back in a major way on the right. Pat Buchanan, I don't know if you guys remember this one, Pat Buchanan ran for president in 1992. And right there, you see a clash that is 30 years later still in the Republican Party between the internationalist Republicans like George H.W. Bush and the America Firsters, as we'll call them, like Pat Buchanan. And boy, this is certainly in play now on a major, major level. And it's dramatically impacting our policy in Ukraine. So isolationism is really alive and well, and it tends to be right now on the extreme left and right of the political spectrum, but especially the right, which maybe isn't so extreme in the sense of influence. I don't know.
But it's a different kind of isolationism to the interwar isolationism, because you do have America does have a gigantic military and an incredible capability at its disposal if it wants to use it, which is not the case in between the wars, we've talked about this a lot on the podcast, of the way that the US military has to expand when the sort of green light's given to facing the fact there's a world crisis. So it's got a different flavor, hasn't it? Because there is a sense that, you know, after all, NATO's American treaty commitment there, you know, the new questioning of that is a sort of, that's the, to me, seems like the alarming bit.
Oh, it's extremely alarming.
Because as you say, it's come and, you know, it's come and gone. The appetite for, you know, the appetite for involvement in the Balkans in the 90s sort of waxed and waned, didn't it? And both parties of both sides, as you say, the Democrats have dragged their heels from a global security perspective, and then the Republicans have too. And very often it's external actors that actually accelerate what happens in American opinion, isn't it? Rather than American opinion, perhaps. There are different wellsprings of American opinion, and it's something comes from elsewhere and spurs American to its sort of response.
Like the Japanese at Pearl Harbor, Al-Qaeda with 9/11, and absolutely. And then there's a kind of inevitable disillusionment that sets in after our involvement in whatever wars we're happening to talk about, even World War II on some levels way back when. We forget that now. But obviously the 21st century Middle East wars. It's true, Al, that there is this enormous military structure and military industrial complex, but the sort of America first point of view now is, let's pull back from pretty much all those military commitments. Why do we have bases in country X, Y, and Z? Why are we doing this? Let's have Fortress America right here, because that's what really matters. And in that sense, it's remarkably similar to the 1920s of saying, well, we live here, and there's the rest of the world out there, and we have contempt for it, and we're just going to hunker down here.
You've also got the sort of recently outgoing head of the U.S. Army Armed Forces, Mark Milley, saying, you know, the Indo-Pacific is where it's all at, and he fears for the next generation of Americans, currently teenagers, that they're going to be the next World War II generation. So it kind of depends on who you're talking to, but the direction all seems to be heading in active participation in kind of global conflicts and global trouble seems to be heading in that direction rather than Europe. But of course, it all depends on November and who wins and actually who's running for president by then.
Absolutely.
You know, as you're saying, you know, there's always been isolationism. There's always been internationalism. It just depends who's in government, really.
Mm-hmm. So that, in that sense, I think there's bound to be a showdown at some point between those two ideas that we can see the commonality throughout these periods of history, and including our own. There is bound to be a showdown as to whether we are going to uphold our commitments or whether we're not. And I mean, you know, yeah, there, for every Milley, there's a Taylor Greene. So that's the unfortunate reality, in my opinion, as an internationalist, as an historian who's seen how bad things can be when the United States is not engaged. To me, we have to learn these lessons. But
there's an eternal question with politics, though, isn't there? Is that especially the sort of oppositional form of politics that we have here too, is that if one side adopts one position, the other has to adopt the other, doesn't it? In order to define itself politically and give itself room for maneuver politically. And, you know, so much of British interwar politics with regards to, you know, appeasement and the post-war settlement and attitudes to Versailles and all that sort of stuff was very much shaped by the oppositional form of British politics. You know, the Versailles Treaty is a product of a liberal government. Then you get a conservative government coming in. And of course, there's a whole load of people in the conservative government who who don't like the Versailles Treaty because it's come from the other side. You know, that these ideas of consensus within politics are very often, they can appear strong, but they actually can be very, very vulnerable and brittle to simply people needing to forge some political space for themselves. And after all, at the moment, you know, American politics, there's someone who has made a virtue, I am going to use that word about Trump, he's made a virtue of creating political space for himself by simply tossing out the things that were consensus, just throwing them away as he's gone, saying the things that were impolite to say, saying the things, crossing all the lines, and demonstrating that actually very often political consensus is as much a position as political differences, you know, that people hold to things because that's good political sense. You know what I mean? Rather than anything they believe or rather than anything they actually hold to themselves. You know, because there's a whole load of people, I think it's fair to say, there's a whole load of people in the Republican Party currently second-guessing the possibility of a Trump presidency, which is why currently they're opposed to aid, military aid going to Ukraine, even though that military aid amounts to money being spent in America on American high-skilled jobs in the armaments industry. You know, that's where the money's going. It's not being given to Ukraine. You know, and were Trump's position different, theirs probably would be too. No one believes any of this, which always makes me tear my hair out about politics, because we've had years of political posturing around big questions that has been purely for advantage and purely to, you know, we had a government where unless you agreed completely with Brexit, you weren't going to get anywhere. To the point of there not actually being a debate about it, just being which side you were on. You know, I think I also think
there is a point where reality trumps posturing, and you know, it's all very well saying, you know, I'm going to be isolationist or I'm going to be internationalist or whatever, but real events have a kind of habit of forcing hands and forcing public opinion.
Yeah.
You know, it's all very well, you know, for saying, well, we're not going to spend anything more on Europe until Europe goes pear-shaped and suddenly American security is a threat, then suddenly it's a whole different ballgame. And, you know, that's exactly what was happening
in the 40s.
1939, 1940, of course. You know, so you have this kind of sort of dramatic, the greatest political volte-face of ever, where Roosevelt goes from being kind of, you know, the New Dealist and ultimate isolationist to going, I want to have 50,000 aircraft built in a year and, you know, let's spend. So it's just, you know, and I suspect, you know, even if Trump gets into power and you know, the suddenly the world finds itself in complete turmoil and, you know, the worst happens, I suspect America's not just going to sit back and let its Western allies kind of just take it.
Well, I hope you're right.
That'll affect the United States as well.
Yeah, well, yes, but, you know, you're speaking rationally now. Others don't look at it that way.
But if only because, you know, Europe is one of America's biggest markets. The American economy needs to trade with Europe.
Money talks, right?
You know. Well, yeah, but that's the sort of mundane rather than the, you know, tanks rolling into somewhere. The question of security means your trade is secure. You know, you only have to, the place where this is being demonstrated is in the Red Sea, after all, you know, where the interconnectedness of things is being laid bare by some people with some drones, you know, and you've got to take that. I'm afraid you have to take that seriously, whoever you are. If you believe roughly in the global status quo in terms of trade, regardless of anything else, you know.
I mean, it's all true, but there's a sense among, I think, many, many of my countrymen that in the end, it's Americans who take the worst end of the stick for all that involvement, and we neglect our problems and issues here. And I think there's a sense among some that they've been left behind as we've sort of looked outward in this internationalist kind of milieu or whatever, and so hence the term America first, which basically means let's worry about solving problems here in America first, and a kind of a blind eye to the fact that it's interconnected with what's going on globally on many levels. So
yeah. I'll tell you what we're going to do. We were going to do another question before a break, but there isn't time. I can see which way this podcast is going to go. We'll see you in a moment after a break.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored? Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
The holidays have arrived early with Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale. Upgrading window coverings can be a minor project with a major impact. Blinds.com makes it easy and affordable. Browse premium blinds, shades, shutters. We have your patio covered too. And get unlimited window treatments installed for one low cost. Free shipping and Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale now. Save up to 45% plus premium doorbusters. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Welcome back to Weird Ways of Making You Talk, where we've manfully answered one question so far out of the 15 I have.
I've gone round and round in circles.
Our next question comes from, listening legend, I'm going to call him Andy Aitchison, Akak Aitchison, who's been with us since the beginning, who asks, this is a good question, what were the key differences in command style between the British, and he uses the word Yanks, I'm afraid, John, between the British and the Yanks, especially in Northwest Europe?
That's such a good question. I would say
it evolves as well, inevitably. It's not a straight line, is it?
I don't think it is, but if I'm generalizing, the British style tends to be a bit more cautious, I guess, in terms of offensive operations. If I'm thinking professionally, I don't know that your career is much on the line in a battalion or regimental or division size attack in this sector and gaining 7 miles of ground by tonight, as it might be in the U.S. Army, where your entire reputation tends to be bound up in how aggressive your division or your regiment or whatever is perceived to be. Whether it really is, I don't know. But the death knell for a career in the U.S. Army at that point is the perception growing that you're not aggressive or you can't, quote, fight your division. In other words, you can't gain ground. You can't that you've always got some level of caution or whatever. You did not want that reputation. You could earn the reputation like of being aggressive. And then later on, you could scale back a little bit and have cautionary tales. And you could have that credibility, but you couldn't operate that way first. And I think maybe that's a little bit different, at least as I perceive it, but I certainly can say that's how it operated in the U.S. Army.
I can think of a few things. I think orders from our starting points for negotiation a lot of the time, coming down from the very top in the British in the British way of doing things. You know, this is your order. This is what we want you to do. Then kind of discuss it. Come back with a solution. You know, with an answer. Whereas in American line, it tends to be a kind of an order from the top is an order from the top, and you just get on and do it. The other thing is, I think the Americans generally have a kind of sort of broad front approach. You know, we've got lots of stuff, so let's smother the enemy all at once along a kind of a big approach. Whereas the British way, because of the kind of shortage of manpower, tends to be much more let's sort of probe and find the weak spots and exploit the weak spot rather than this kind of broad front approach. So I think those are the two major differences. I mean, it's really interesting, I mean, obviously, I'm immersed in Italy at the moment, and Lucas, when he gets to Anzio, he hasn't spent a huge amount of time with the British contingent, which is predominantly the first infantry division, and he says, I can't understand what they're saying half the time. it's not the accent so much. It's more the choice of words. And I think particularly at that time, I think it's being whittled away a little bit in the last sort of 30, 40 years. But the British had a sort of huge penchant for sort of talking in sort of analogously.
Like talking in metaphors and
metaphors and all this sort of stuff, and lots of references to cricket and we're going to hit them for six, and we're going to do this, and that's a sticky wicket, and all this sort of stuff. And if you're American, you're just thinking, what the heck, what is all this stuff? So it's not that they don't understand the words; it's just they don't understand the context in which those phrases are being used. And I think there's a bit of that going on.
But a lot of this comes from, one of the primary differences is that the British Army doesn't kind of shut down completely between the two wars, or not to the extent that the American army, the American army expands greatly. The First World War goes back to normal in the second. The British is kind of carrying on. It's not as big, but it's kind of carrying on, isn't it, Jim? And its officer culture, officer culture resides in regimental traditions, even though those regiments aren't as old as they like to pretend they are, because they're all actually late Victorian inventions from the Haldane reforms and all that sort of stuff. But there's a sort of well of way of doing things that comes from that regimental tradition, which I think is sort of what you're talking about here, this sort of this shorthand, this language.
Well, it's also there's sort of studied insouciance, isn't there? And sort of play, you know, British playing everything down. I mean, I've just been reading Those Devils in Baggy Pants, and I'm also reading an account of an action by a kind of a British commander. And literally it is written in the same language, but that's about the only similarity. I mean, yeah. They're so different in attitude. Well, you know, we pour some lead into some kraut heads is kind of, you know, the Ross Carter kind of approach.
Much blunter.
Whereas this was, well, the British Irish Guards commander is going, and then my number three company was completely overrun, which was obviously a bit of a problem.
Yeah. See, that's what it gets to the heart of the. One of the American soldiers said something, and I'm paraphrasing. He said something, in effect, his perception was the British play themselves in a constant production, like an imitation of themselves. And what he meant is that kind of, like you said, that studied insouciance sort of, and that penchant for understatement. And for many Americans, and I'm talking at the command level, but also the soldiers, many Americans were enthralled by that and amused by it. It's so different than the sort of blunt American and really sardonic humor, too, the kind of black humor the Americans had. But some of them found it also really irritating, too, like when a horrifying battle would be referred to as a show. It's been quite a show or something. And so I do think that revealed a very interesting cultural difference.
Yes, he said, okay, so listen to this. It says, I said that, you know, I rang up brigade saying it's no good taking another slice to fill it up. We must have tanks, even a troop, by first light. I reiterated this statement at about 2 hourly intervals to try and impress upon brigade the seriousness of the situation. And then he says, this was all made rather difficult as one had no idea really of what the situation at number three company was. whole company's been overrun. That's what the situation is. I mean, it's just extraordinary.
But a chunk of this is tied up in class, right?
Of course.
We're going to generalize here, but what you don't have in the American army is anything like the stratifications of class and also the reinforcements of class that exist within the officer structures. You know, the British Army, chaps look out for each other. If you've gone to the right school, you know, there's that amazing scene south of Nijmegen where there's a powwow between all the armoured brigade people, and one went to Westminster, you know, one went to, another one's a Wickhamist, and you know, they're all in their old school, they're all Etonians. It's just that binding and bonding and looking out for each other, and also the sort of the shorthand of the language that comes with, isn't present in the American army in that way, is it? I mean, it's
not in the same way. You do have some elements of class, of course. Your officers are probably come from a little bit better socioeconomic circumstances, likely. You've got the professional class of West Pointers. I mean, certainly that. And I think the biggest divide for the Americans is race, honestly, because if you don't happen to be white, then you are an underclass on some levels. And that would be the true divide. Among whites, there really isn't quite as hardcore of a delineation, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, that actually nicely leads us to our next question. So Nereus asks, are there any Hispanic-specific units in the military? Are they fully integrated? Same for citizens of German descent. Does that guarantee they are to serve in the Pacific? So how does it break down, or does it?
Yeah, great question. In a general sense, if you're Hispanic, basically you're almost considered to be white institutionally among the American armed forces, and you'll be integrated with everybody else. There are some exceptions. You've got a Puerto Rican National Guard unit, the 65th Infantry. They're not major combat players in World War II. They will be in Korea. They're going to be part of the 3rd ID, actually, in Korea. So you did at least have something of that level of tradition. Then you've got another unit. This is Arizona National Guard, 158th Infantry or Regimental Combat Team, which contains it's really quite a diverse unit, especially by the standards of the U.S. military forces at that time. So you've got whites, many of whom are sort of cowboy and rancher types. And then you've got many Mexican-Americans, and you have many Native Americans, too, all serving in the same unit. Now, they serve in the Pacific as an independent regimental combat team. There is no to my knowledge, any rhyme or reason that they're going to serve in the Pacific rather than Europe. It's just wherever they happen to be needed. But it's really quite interesting because there's no question that as a Latino, Hispanic, or whatever, you would not have had probably the same kind of social advantages as whites. And if you were Mexican Americans from South Texas, you were dealing with segregation, almost like Jim Crow. But the federal institutions that existed at that time would have looked upon you more or less the same as whites, and you would have probably been integrated per capita, I'm saying.
Well, if you think about Audie Murphy's squad, you know, he's got there's a guy from, he's a second generation Pole. There's the Cherokee marksman. There's a couple of Irish guys, mm-hmm. you know, he's from.
Yeah, Kerrigan. Yeah,
Murphy's
exactly.
Murphy's obviously, yeah.
Irish.
He's yep. really called Martin Kelly. So yeah. He's Irish, and then there's obviously Murphy himself. He mm-hmm. presumably comes from Irish descent.
And that's kind of the classic polyglot of an American military unit at that time among whites and Latinos and Native Americans, I suppose. But if you were black, it was completely different. And that, you know, that was another window into the reality for African Americans at that time, that they really were set aside in this lower caste and stigmatized on so many levels, institutionally, I guess, too. And I think they're quite resentful, understandably so, saying, well, anybody else can serve together like any other American except us. Why? And that's one of the things that leads to change.
What about citizens of German descent? What goes on there? Because
nothing at all. It makes no difference.
Yeah, you'll have some people who are actual German nationals, you know, who are in play in the U.S. or very, very recent immigrant backgrounds or whatever, who, you know, might run sideways with the FBI or whatever. But yeah, I mean, you're talking about massive numbers of millions of Americans who have German heritage by the 1940s. So now you're in with everybody else. Maybe you take some ribbing, I suppose, if your name was Heiner Schmidt or something, and you know, you were a second generation German. But no, that's yeah, it's, you know, and that's another example of what's happening in America at that time. If you were Japanese American, well, now you're in the crosshairs and quite possibly going to be incarcerated somewhere. Whereas German Americans, Italian Americans, seriously? No, not at all.
Yeah, and you have that. You have the 100th Battalion, the Nisei, Japanese Americans fighting with the Red Bulls. But yeah, it's completely different, isn't it? It's amazing.
And if you're a German speaker, does that count for you? Do you end up more likely in an intelligence job?
You probably would, yeah. And you know, of course, you have famously, you know, like the Ritchie boys and whatnot. You know, refugees who have come here, and they're a real force multiplier for the U.S. Armed Forces in this war. People who have fled Hitler's persecution. But yeah, if you're a German speaker in general, one thing that's different about World War II versus World War One. World War One, we had this kind of mindless sort of backlash against anything German. And so German language is eradicated from schools, and which is very self-defeating, of course. World War II, we don't have that. So if you were a German speaker, you were pretty valuable, and they were going to make pretty good use of you.
Because, I mean, obviously it's different, but what happens in the UK with German exiled nationals tend to be Jews is that first of all, you're interned as an illegal alien, and you're not allowed a bicycle, and you're sent to the Isle of Man, and all this sort of stuff. Jim and I have just talked about on a trip we did to the National Archive, and then the next thing you know, you're meant to join up, but you're only allowed in the Pioneer Corps, so you're only allowed to dig ditches. So you've all these sort of, I've been reading an account of a guy who says, as a result, you know, because we were all well educated, middle class, nice Jewish boys, there was, you know, it wasn't a sweary soldiers unit. It was all very polite and people asking each other politely if they mind digging a ditch or that sort of thing, rather than being yelling at each other. And then eventually it loosens up and you get in the army proper. And you do find, you know, by the last 2 years, and this is obviously partly a reflection of the manpower crisis the British are beginning to experience. It's like, well, we're going to have to use everybody. We could stop holding our nose about using these people, which is clearly how the establishment felt. And you get German Jews sprinkling in, and obviously they then become really useful because they can, you know, persuade sentries that they'd forgotten the password and then sneak up on people and kill them and all that sort of stuff. But it's interesting, isn't it? Because in America, you've got such a well, I mean, like you say, millions of people who are German, and yet millions of people who are mobilized to fight for the US. There are some nationalists. There are some people who go home. But really, generally, it's they believe in America or something, or believe in what the US can offer them as citizens, or that they have a duty to. And I think that's really, really, really interesting, isn't it? As a sort of, it is.
And many, and of course, millions of those German Americans have roots in America that go back 100 years by World War II. And of course, so it I think in a way it's a microcosm for what is often best about this country, that on some levels we poached the best talent in a way from all these countries all over the planet that comes into our famous melting pot or whatever. And I think in World War II, we really realized some of the benefits of that, not just German American, but Italian Americans too. I mean, I think that's fascinating, that whole discourse of what happens with Italian Americans in the Italian campaign. So there, yeah, and of course, Japanese Americans. I mean, that's maybe one of the best examples I could give. You know, Jim mentioned the 100th. Of course, there's the 442nd Regimental Combat Team eventually. And then there's all sorts of Japanese Americans who serve in the Pacific and are, of course, hugely valuable as interpreters, as intel people, reconnaissance. I mean, whatever it would be, there's a lot of different jobs, rangers. So it's really quite amazing.
Right. Jake Hayward, who is one of our New Zealand listeners, he came to the last Warfest, actually, in his Anzac hat. Well, I think we nicknamed him the Anzac Cove. Anyway, he asks this, and we speak so rarely about our Kiwi allies. So how did US soldiers in the Pacific get on with their New Zealand counterparts, e.g. on New Caledonia, Guadalcanal, Velalavela, etc.? Or at garrison in New Zealand proper, thinking the Battle of Manners Street, he says. Because, I mean, we've touched on some American-Australian relations, and obviously within the Duke setup, there's all sorts of push and shove backwards and forwards between the different elements of, it's particularly the Mediterranean, soldiers from the New Zealand armies and soldiers from the Australian army, and where they fit into the picture and all that. So what are relations like between Americans and Kiwis?
You know, I think they're remarkably similar to our relations with the Australians and the British in general. Get along very well. There's all sorts of heartwarming stories about Americans based in New Zealand who are welcomed by host families and consummate very strong friendships. Anytime that American forces are operating with New Zealand military forces, the relationship tends to be solid and productive and good allies together. With, of course, the always obvious exception and caveat that we wear out our welcome pretty quickly when we start to take their women. when we are throwing our money around and our better uniforms and all the usual kind of American kind of vulgarities that could come from that. More too much drinking. And so it's really, I think, not all that different than what you've got with our other Western-oriented allies.
Right, okay.
And I tend to think that, again, I think I've told you you guys this before, but I tend to think the bulk of the tension really is generated by the Americans and things they're saying, choices they're making, you know, just the kind of general vibe sometimes. And because also, remember, these American forces are huge and they're fractious too, and they're diverse and whatnot. And so, you know, you got a lot of people there who are not very good representatives of your country, diplomats, shall we say. And that's just the nature of the beast, you know? I mean, we can't control everything as commanders in that respect. So I think it's a pretty positive relationship overall, though.
Yeah, I mean, young men who've been trained to fight who are bored. I mean, it's, there you are. That's a automatically.
They're bored and they're full of themselves. Just having to, I think there's a kind of an American mindset of, okay, well, I've uprooted my life and I've gotten aboard a ship and traveled thousands of miles away and I'm here to save you. You know, there's already a kind of an American condescension toward the rest of the world, I think, on some levels. And it's like, okay, well, you guys drew us into World War I, you drew us into World War II, and now you need us again. Okay, I'm here to save you. And now with the Americans here, things will just be fine. And, you know, and you look at like the soldier pamphlets of the time, and they're usually really cautioning against that attitude. They basically to use 21st century words, are saying, hey, dude, you know, these folks you're with now have been fighting for years, you know, and this is a personal war to them. And if their cities look shabby or whatever, it's because they're freaking getting bombed, or, you know, because they're under duress and they've been rationing for years. And you're pretty lucky compared to all this. And you need to behave yourself and respect your allies. It's a terrific message. And I think it resonates no matter what time period we're talking about. But I think overall, again, I'd say these are, when you look at alliances throughout human history, these are terrifically successful and good alliances. I mean, it's a good relationship.
Yeah. Okay, there we go. A huge thanks for your questions. And those of you who sent us questions, I'm just looking down the list, that we didn't get around to, but there we go. If you're a listener, you know that's the deal. Let's be honest now. We might not get to you. No surprises. Great to speak to you, John. I'm sure next time we talk, we'll be going, bloody hell, episode 6 of Masters of the Air. What was that all about? Thanks, everyone, for listening. We will see you all again very soon. Cheerio.
Cheerio.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.